This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A lot is made of the differences between men and women, right? Especially when it comes to their biology. But when it comes to the brain in particular, it turns out that this organ can't be constrained by the typical male and female categories. A new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week finds that our brains are often a little bit male, a little bit female, and a lot in between. Here with more on what the researchers described as mosaics of features, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Rachel Feltman. She writes for and runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Good to see you, Rachel.
Good to see you too, Ira.
Mosaic of features.
Yeah, so basically this study is arguing that at least when it comes to the brain, it's time to throw out the gender binary. Obviously, there are some features that are more typically male, more typically female. Male brains are larger. There's difference in ratio of gray to white matter, difference in the size of certain structures. But this study was the first one to look at a large number of scans, looking specifically at these supposed male-typical, female-typical structures and what have you. And they found that it's really exceptionally rare for a brain to have all the male type structures or all the female type structures or even all ones that are somewhere between the two. It's much more likely to have a mosaic. And, you know, you could argue, oh, this doesn't mean anything. Brain structure doesn't necessarily relate to behavior. But, you know, we already knew that that was true. But the point is, it's hard to take those structures and turn them into a male brain and a female brain. It's much more complicated than that and much more interesting.
Yeah, because we have the other word gender to deal with.
Right.
Too, right?
Well, and, you know, gender is already such a weird, confusing, interesting concept. So adding this to the mix, you know, is going to make for some really interesting studies in the future, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to this idea that, I found it was very intriguing because I know that no one can hear you scream in space, as they say in the movies. But can they hear you burp, especially if you're a black hole?
If you're a black hole, they can hear you burp, apparently. A study looked at a black hole about 300 million light years away. And black holes consume stars all the time. We know this. We've seen it. But this is the first time that we've seen kind of the entire process. Looking at radio signals from the black hole, researchers were able to see this black hole jet that gets emitted after a star is consumed. It's kind of like a hot plasma burp of some of the material that it consumed from the star. And it's just very exciting because we'd seen these jets before. They were quite sure that they were the result of stars being, you know, taken in by black holes. But this is the first time they've really, you know, seen the whole connected process. So it's, you know, it suggests that this is indeed where these jets of hot plasma come from and that we'll be able to see more of them as we look for the radio signals on other black holes.
Wow. Okay. So burping black holes. Like they've had a bad meal. Have researchers found evidence, and this was really interesting, of a real-life Loch Ness monster?
Yeah, sort of. So on the Isle of Skye, researchers found the largest ever set of evidence of dinosaurs, specifically sauropods, relatives of our beloved Brontosaurus, among other, you know, long-necked plant eaters. It's about 170 million years old, and their footprints, they're the first sauropod footprints ever found in Scotland. They look like these big potholes, and some of them are as much as 2 feet across.
Wow.
And what's cool about them is that they're in an area that used to be kind of a swampy beach. And that's interesting if you know about the history of sauropods. We used to think that their bodies were so weird that they couldn't possibly support their weight unless they were aquatic.
That's why they were in the water all the time.
Right.
To hold them up.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they were redeemed as land dwellers. You know, scientists figured out that they could actually support their own weight. But now we see that even though they did spend most of their time on land, they apparently liked to wade in the water occasionally. The scientists think they were probably looking for food or hiding from predators, but for whatever reason, they were at the beach in Scotland, and they're pretty Nessie-like, I would argue.
Now, this was not a recent sighting, right?
No, this was 170 million years ago.
Viral. So. It's 170 million year old footprints.
Yes.
On the shores of areas that could have that were lakes, mm-hmm. but not Loch Ness itself.
No.
See,
no.
That's the
Isle of Skye.
I want to make sure we get that one in. And last up, I saw this on the internet, a super old peach.
Yes.
A peach of a find in China.
Yes, in southwestern China, in an area by a bus station where construction had unearthed this rock from the Pliocene. So they're 2.5 million years old, these eight peach pits. And what's exciting about them is that they are basically identical to the pits found in modern peaches. So the scientists can't actually reconstruct the fruit, so they've named them as a new species since they can't be sure, but they're pretty certain that these peaches were really like modern peaches, maybe just a tiny bit smaller. And that's exciting because they're 2.5 million years old and humans only started cultivating things maybe 10,000 years ago. So it's an indication that the peach as we know it pretty much got to where it is today through natural selection and not with much help from humans. And it's also a pretty good indication that the peach did originate in China, which people have long suspected. But until now, the oldest evidence was about 8,000 years old.
Right.
So obviously 2.5 million is a big improvement.
Well, what really struck me about looking at these fossils is how they look exactly like
right.
a peach pit,
they
right?
They look exactly the same.
And but they're millions of years old.
Yes.
Wow. Well, you would think that a lot of times they just find a print of something like a two-dimensional thing on a rock, but this time they found the whole peach pit.
Right, and all of the dating checked out, you know, in addition to being in this layer of rock that is definitely 2.5 million years old, the pits do also seem to be of that age. So the peach has a long and delicious history, much older than humankind.
There you have it. It's the pits, but it's good this time. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel Feltman is a writer, and she also runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Over 20 years ago, the National Institutes of Health created its Office of Research on Women's Health to increase the number of women and ethnic minority groups in clinical studies. And today, women make up a little over half of the participants in NIH-funded studies, a big improvement, and goes along with the population. But when it comes to laboratory studies, the subjects are still typically male. Male mice, that is. So NIH is rolling out a new policy in 2016. That seeks to increase the number of females at this level of research. And while parity between the sexes, be they human or mice, sounds good on the face of it, some researchers have concerns about the changes. Here to talk about the good and the bad of the policy shift at NIH is Azin Goreshi. She is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News in New York. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so the good thing about this.
Right. So, like you said, traditionally, female animals have sort of been excluded from preclinical research because it was thought that their hormonal cycles could sort of muddle the data. So most research was done using male animals. With the rise of sort of a women's health research movement, they said, look, this is paternalistic. This is also biased. And we're also seeing sort of differences in outcomes for women's health, possibly due to the fact that we don't know that much about how mm-hmm. female biology works. So one of the things they brought up was, for example, heart attacks. In young women who have heart attacks, they're twice as likely to die as young men. And then they also brought up the case of Ambien, which in 2013, the FDA actually had to slash the dosage requirements for women in half because all these women were sleepwalking, they weren't driving very, very drowsily, they were even having sex while they were, like, asleep. And all of this, they say, is due to the fact that, you know, we're not really putting in the work ahead of time to understand how female biology differs
from
male.
So this was good intentions that they
right.
had.
Right.
But the bad news?
So this is a paper that came out a couple weeks ago in PNAS. They're arguing that sort of requiring across the board that people who are doing preclinical research look at sex could bring up sex differences that don't really exist in humans. So first of all, we don't really know what sex means at the level of cells or at the level of animals and what that how that sort of translates to sex differences in humans. Second of all, they say that a lot of the differences we see, particularly in health inequities between men and women, have to do with social causes. So for heart attacks, for example, women are less likely to think of heart attacks as a female disease. Mm-hmm. So they're less likely to phone it in. They're less likely to go to the doctor, even when they're having symptoms. In the case of Ambien, for example, it took studying it in embodied humans to understand that it was not actually a sex difference. It was a difference in body weight that had to do with how quickly the Ambien was metabolized. So really, and then the last point actually that she makes is that sort of back to what Rachel was talking about earlier, is that the history of studying sex differences in science is sort of fraught. In the 19th century, for example, they studied the size of different parts of female brains to sort of justify certain stereotypes, also in ethnic minorities such as African Americans, that turned out to be damaging. Mm-hmm. And we have to think about sort of whether we're asking the right questions and really make sure that if we are going to be studying sex differences, that we're doing it in the right way.
Yeah, we should. So don't spend so much time in the petri dishes studying the sex differences after you apply it to clinical or real cases.
Right, definitely. They specifically said, you know, we don't even know what sex means at the level of, you know, something that's in a dish.
And then we get back to that whole gender question.
Yeah, which right? is a whole nother.
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting. Thank you very much for joining us today. Azin Gureshi is a science reporter at BuzzFeed News here in New York. We're going to take a short break. And you know what's going on in Paris this week is that that climate meeting is going on in the air. Lots of people from, almost 200 countries are meeting. And we're going to talk about some of the interesting points that are being made there at the UN Climate. And we'll talk about what we expect to come out of it. And maybe things that are not going so well. Maybe there's something that should be talked about that might be more useful that's not being talked about. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. This week, the 21st UN Climate Conference got underway in Paris. In a departure from past conferences, perhaps to add some gravitas to the meeting, many heads of state arrived on the first day to kick off the conference, including President Obama.
Here in Paris, let's secure an agreement that builds in ambition, where progress paves the way for regularly updated targets. Targets that are not set for each of us, but by each of us, taking into account the differences that each nation is facing.
We've been through Kyoto in 97, Copenhagen in 09 without an agreement. Will this conference be any different? Will India, for example, and developing countries have a bigger say in these talks? And what should we watch for in the coming week, maybe even longer than that? My next guest is in Paris following the talks. She's here to walk us through what's happening so far. Lisa Friedman is deputy editor of Climate Wire. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How's it going so far? You've been to quite a few of these, and you call these the Super Bowl of climate conferences. What's it like on the ground there?
Thanks. Well, yeah, this is my eighth COP now, is it called, Conference of the Parties. And it feels like a different COP. Normally the way these start out is a lot of posturing in the beginning. You know, countries fight about agendas for 2, 3, 4 days before beginning to think about starting getting down to business. And this started out with a lot of momentum. Like you said, we had President Obama. We had heads of state from nearly 150 countries. Cristiana Figueres, the head of the UNFCCC, called it a world record. Never before, apparently, have so many world leaders come to talk about one thing on one day. Even the UN General Assembly is spread out over 3, 4 days. So the mood, until just recently, was pretty high. Now things are getting into the nitty-gritty, and I think there's a lot of concern from a lot of different quarters that getting an agreement over the next week is going to be really pretty tough.
Because of so many conflicting interests.
Exactly. I mean, this is... I have a profile coming out Monday of our U.S. Envoy, Todd Stern, and one of the things he said in this kind of dry humor was, look, this is an agreement that will affect the economies, that will affect the economic sectors of every economy of every country. and so you can't expect it, you know. So just that, right? I mean, it's only that. It's a huge, huge lift to try and get 195 countries to agree on how to reduce emissions, whether to reduce emissions, and how to divide up the responsibility fairly.
Yeah, it doesn't look like, from my vantage point, that there's going to be anything binding coming out, will there? It's going to be a lot of probably a voluntary agreement.
So you raise a good question. It depends on what the meaning of legally binding is. Everybody's using this phrase, and I think that a lot of people are loading it with their own meaning. The United States says that it wants a legally binding agreement. Obviously, they mean something very different than what Europeans mean or very vulnerable island countries. The U.S. position and what they've been pushing for is an agreement where everything is binding except the targets themselves. So that is, the U.S. has promised to reduce emissions economy-wide 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. China has pledged to cut emissions, China has pledged to peak its emissions by 2030. What the U.S. is saying is we will be obligated to report and monitor and verify that we are working towards reaching our target, but countries should not be held to some kind of enforcement standard for meeting those top-level targets. EU sees things very differently. They are pushing very hard to get the United States to agree to that, or at the very least to promise to implement the policies. A lot of things in these talks come down to fights over the words shall and should. You know, thousands of lawyers working on these agreements. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a hybrid, and everybody will be able to describe it the way they want to.
Yeah. And one of the key players in this that no one talks about, but not in the past agreements very much, but a country that is moving up in population and will soon overtake China in population is India.
India is a huge player here. So just to back up, one of the very significant things about what's happening here and the way it's happening here is that it's really a fundamentally different agreement from the Kyoto Protocol that you mentioned earlier. That 1997 agreement divided the world into two categories of countries, wealthy countries who were obligated to act and everybody else. And everybody else ranged from India and China, Brazil, all the way down to very poor countries like Bangladesh or tiny islands. This time around, you've got more than 180 countries, including India, including China, who have put forward submissions of how they will address emissions. Some of them are economy-wide targets. Some of them are absolute cuts like Brazil. Some of them are like India's, promising to cut emissions relative to their GDP growth. India here is really in an interesting position because on the one hand, they're acting quite ambitiously at home. They have a massive solar program. They just made a rather large announcement with Bill Gates to double their domestic research and development for clean energy. And yet they've also taken a very hardline position on a number of things. They want to see intellectual property rights given to them to help develop some of their clean energy. And they're really holding firm to a lot of positions that make the U.S. uncomfortable. They want to make sure that even though developing countries are coming to the table, that the world does not forget that climate change is a problem that was caused by wealthy countries. And they are not shy about repeating that over and over. And I think that's a very difficult thing for a lot of developed countries to swallow.
Yeah, you got yours. All this is you're doing. Why should we be held accountable for
it? Actually, I'd say that the conversation has changed a little bit to, you've gotten yours. If you want us to grow in a different way than you did, and remember that, in that there's not a single country in the world that's gotten rich without fossil fuels, these countries are saying, if you want us to do something very different, then you need to help us. And so that makes money one of the biggest issues here. All roads on every other issue lead back to money.
Yeah. It always does, doesn't it?
It does.
I want to bring on...
sorry.
Yeah, you know, and if you give us money, we can help catch up. But we're poor. But that's why we're called developing countries.
And that money is really not forthcoming yet. That's, I think, one of the final issues that developed countries know that money is going to unlock a lot of other issues that are stuck, but it's not something that you're going to see movement on until ministers come back here. John Kerry comes back next week, and that's when you'll start to see some things move, I believe.
Well, and the U.S. Congress is already on record as saying they're not giving any money for anything new.
Well, that's the other issue, exactly. And the other day, I asked Laurent Fabius, the French foreign minister, about the vote that Congress held. House voted to gut the Clean Power Plan, the cornerstone of the Obama administration's pledge in Paris. And he really shrugged it off. You know, he said, Obama told me that this was going to happen, and we're not surprised. And when it comes to the money, you have a contingent of Democratic lawmakers who just arrived in Paris. I spoke to Senator Brian Schatz this morning, and he said that he's been assuring people that the money, in this case, the U.S. has pledged $3 billion over 4 years for something called the Green Climate Fund, a U.N.-created but independent fund to help countries deal with climate change. The first tranche of that, $500 million, Republicans say dead on arrival, not going anywhere. And Schatz and other Democrats are out here telling people that they actually think there's a reasonable chance, and even if it doesn't come this year, it will come.
Yeah.
We'll have to see.
All right, let's see. I want to move on and bring on someone else to join the conversations. As you say, these negotiations center around limiting emissions, but how accurate are our measurements of greenhouse gases? I want to bring on another guest who is researching that, and he created a camera to measure the amount of methane in the air. David Basvikin is a professor of environmental change at the Linköping University in Linköping, Sweden. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about why we need to measure methane.
Well, methane is the second most important greenhouse gas at the moment, and so it's growing quickly in the atmosphere, and it's growing irregularly. So we don't understand it as well as we understand carbon dioxide. So and it's growing in importance as well. So we have to find good ways of mm-hmm. targeting emissions.
So you've built a camera that can detect methane levels. How does it work?
Well, it's basically a camera. It's called a hyperspectral camera. It records a normal image, but for each pixel in this image, you also get a spectrum, an infrared spectrum, where some gases absorb this infrared light, and they show up. Then you get absorption peaks, and you get like a fingerprint of different gases for each pixel in the image. So then mm-hmm. you can determine how many gas molecules you have between the camera and the background for each pixel in the image. Mm-hmm. And then you can build an image of the gas concentrations, and also if you take many images over time, you can actually make a movie and you can see fluxes.
So this actually fills in a gap, a hole in the technology for measuring methane.
Right. We have a number of good measurement techniques. We have near the ground, we typically have very sensitive techniques for doing point measurements. And then you have the remote sensing techniques that usually are used from space to map larger areas, square kilometer-sized areas. But we're missing the capacity to sort of mapping fluxes and concentrations near the ground, where all the mm-hmm. action is, because the emissions are actually happening from local processes near the ground. And if we just wanted to, you know, what if we could see these emissions and visualize and see them, image them, then we could see where the fluxes come from, and we could actually pinpoint where we can do good measures to reduce emissions.
Well, good luck to you. We'll look forward to seeing your camera in action, David.
Okay, thank you.
David Basvikin is professor of environmental change at the Linköping University in Sweden. Not only are diplomats negotiating terms, but this week Bill Gates announced he'll contribute $1 billion to create, quote, early stage investing in potentially transformative energy systems with near zero carbon emissions. want to bring on another guest to weigh in on this. Stephen Cohen is executive director of Columbia University's Earth Institute here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
In that interview, Bill Gates said that getting developing and poor countries to switch to clean energy, the technology needs to be cheaper and better. And the only answer to that is an innovation. You got to innovate. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what's really important about what's going on in Paris right now is it's focusing everybody's attention on how difficult the issue is. And the only way to really address climate change is with a transformative technology.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the Paris agreements with Stephen Cohen at the moment. There was a joint statement by corporations like Royal Dutch Shell and 13 other big carbon industries supporting these talks. They seem to have been reading all over the Internet what they've been saying. They seem to be wanting a carbon tax or some real guidance on how to move forward.
Well, there's not going to be a carbon tax, and there's not going to be mandatory reductions or anything like that. But what there is going to be is a drive to transform the energy base of our economies. The thing to understand is that energy is not like regulating anything else we've ever tried to regulate. It's so central to modern life and economic life and really to the political stability of regimes because of that, that you simply can't regulate it the way you could a toxic substance. And so what you have to do is come up with a technology that is truly transformative. You need to move to a cheaper, more reliable, and cleaner form of energy than what the modern economy has been built on. Without that, we simply will never solve the climate change issue.
But we keep talking about, and we keep hearing that the switch to natural gas, which is in great abundance, is the stepping stone to getting to something where we want to go to more green-friendly technologies. Would you agree that that's going to work?
No. I mean, it's better than coal. But what you really have to do is understand that fossil fuels are finite, and getting them out of the planet is destructive, and burning them is destructive. So we have, 20 or 30 years to make this transition, maybe 30 or 40 years, but we're going to have to do it. And we're going to have to move away from the current base of fossil fuels. And I think that these companies are recognizing, in some ways, the way Abu Dhabi recognized, this is a short-term business, whether at least when you measure it in decades or centuries, and mm-hmm. we have to get out of it.
At least at the meeting, do you see the big corporations, the fossil fuel companies, seeing the handwriting on the wall now about switching?
You know, yes and no. What happens in the negotiating halls, it tends to be very disconnected from what happens in the real world and on the ground. The Gates announcement, that's a story that I broke, actually, and it was, and you mentioned natural gas, and I talked to a number of the people who are involved, and they were saying that part of the aim of this is to help drive the cost of renewable energy down below natural gas, even though it's a bridge fuel to negate the need for that. It made a massive impact the first day of the talks. It was helped build the momentum. People were pleased about it. Similarly, you've got a lot of discussions happening on the sidelines about carbon tax. But once the nitty-gritty of the negotiation starts going, very little from the outside world filters into those hallways and those meeting rooms. They are focused on text and commas and semicolons.
The lawyers are there, is what you're saying.
It's thousands of them.
All right, we're gonna, rather than get into another topic, let me take. We're coming up on a break here, so let me just say we're going to take a break. We're talking with Lisa Friedman, deputy editor of ClimateWare. She is in Paris on the ground, describing the reality of what's going on. Stephen Cohen, executive director of Columbia University's Earth Institute in New York, is back in the States here. We're going to talk more about this, see if we can get a phone call or two in 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the Paris Climate Talks with Lisa Friedman, deputy editor of Climate Wire, who's over there in Paris. Stephen Cohen, executive director of Columbia University's Earth Institute in New York. Let me see if I can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Alan, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician, and I'm hopeful that sooner or later health will become an important issue in the climate discussions. Heat is already the leading cause of weather-related death in the United States, and it's important worldwide. And undernutrition is an unappreciated problem, particularly in third-world countries, where many children are below the 50 percentile in terms of the appropriate weight for age. These children have development problems that impairs them permanently for the rest of their lives and makes it difficult for these countries to climb out of the states of poverty that they're in now. And the good news is that this is an important public health opportunity. We know how to take care of many of these problems if there is a sufficient political will to do that. And one of the things that we've learned in medicine is that prevention is always better than treatment. It's less expensive, and it's more merciful and helpful.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that comment, Alan. Steve, any reaction?
Well, I think that the climate issue does affect where we're going to be able to grow food and how much we're going to be able to grow. On the other hand, we are actually creating more calories on the planet than we can use. Our problem is that rich people throw out a lot of food and poor people don't have access to it. So I don't think that's largely an environmental issue. It's really more of a political issue. But one of the things I did want to mention about the issue of energy and climate is that this idea of raising the price of fossil fuels through a carbon tax or some other pricing mechanism is a political non-starter in most parts of the world, and particularly in the United States. So I think the emphasis should be, instead of trying to raise the price of fossil fuels for the true cost to be reflected, to lower the price of renewable energy so it actually drives fossil fuels from the marketplace. And I think that we're actually hearing that conversation with Gates and others now in a dominant way, because we're starting to realize that these kinds of negotiations are really not going to end up having the kind of impact that we need them to have.
Probably the biggest vocal proponent of carbon, taxing carbon, is Jim Hansen, the guy.
Yeah. No, I know Jim very well, and he's a brilliant climate modeler. But I think that the understanding of how you actually bring about technological innovation and political change really has to be built on a reality base. The U.S. Congress is not going to raise the price of energy. In fact, most parts of the world are trying to figure out ways of having a smaller part of the GDP used for energy. And so that's a non-starter. And because we actually know that fossil fuels eventually will become, because they're finite, will become more expensive, and that renewable energy with technological innovation will become cheaper. And in fact, we've seen over the last several years the historic crossover, so that some forms of solar energy are actually cheaper than fossil fuels in certain places. We have to now turn that into a permanent cost equation.
Mm-hmm. Lisa,
Ian,
any
can
reaction?
Can I bring in on the health question?
Yeah.
I just to say that, it is island countries and African countries and least developed countries here are acutely aware of the health issues that the caller raised. And even though health isn't being talked about directly in the negotiations, it's coming into play in a lot of places. Most directly, one of the big fights that's happening here is about what the objective of this whole agreement is supposed to be. Is it supposed to Back in Copenhagen, they had talked about keeping temperatures below a 2-degree rise, 2-degree Celsius rise over pre-industrial levels. About 100 very vulnerable countries are now calling for 1.5. It's something that India has not wanted to see, Saudi Arabia has not wanted to see, for various reasons. Countries are coming around on that, maybe, but what you hear a lot from island countries, African countries, and others are a lot of the health concerns that your caller raised, that their croplands are are endangered, that, you know, at 2 degrees they face, whether it's from coral reefs or crop yields, a lot more threats than they do at 1.5.
And also some of them are going underwater quickly.
Absolutely. We heard from a number of island presidents this week who really brought that existential threat home.
Well, at the end of all these talks, even if we do come up with an agreement, as I said before, and we talked about before, none of these negotiations will be binding on any of these.
So here's the thing, though. I mean, it really depends. Okay, so there's different views on this. But one of the things that I've heard from a lot of legal experts is if countries' targets are based in their domestic policies, if countries are following their policies at home, then that's a lot better than some notion of internationally legally binding. Mm-hmm. You can take that or leave that, you know, idea. There's plenty who disagree. You know, I know European leaders are much more comfortable with international pacts than Americans are. You know, the question of whether or not the United States goes forward with its own policies and regulations to address greenhouse gases is its own huge question. But assuming that the Obama administration's regulations on greenhouse gases go forward, I think there's a legitimate question to be asked about whether it really matters whether this is a full treaty or not.
Yeah. But Steve, what's your take on that?
Well, I think the regulations and the policies set a framework and a set of expectations. I think what's actually more important right now is that young people really understand that the climate issue, and not just climate, but threats to biodiversity and to the oceans and to the planet itself and its ability to provide us with air, food, and water. These are central issues for the generation coming of age right now. And I think they understand that in a way that people of my age had to learn as time went on. So I think we're going to see some of these changes, but it's not going to be a top-down policy promulgated by Washington or by the international community. We're actually seeing a lot of action at the community level. What we need in addition to this, though, is the transformative technologies. And what I mean by that is ask yourself the question, 20 years ago, did you think that you'd be carrying a computer in your pocket and that it would become so essential to life that if your smartphone goes down, you sort of get nervous and don't even know how to live? This is really what we have to see happen in renewable energy.
All right. What would we do differently than promoting more solar or more wind energy research? You're talking about maybe batteries or something that we don't even know exists yet.
Well, I would say that of the existing technologies, if you could make solar cells more efficient and smaller and lighter, the same way we did, by the way, with computers, because the computer I used in graduate school was the size of my living room, and it had less computing power than my iPhone has. So if we could do that to solar cells, and we could do that to battery technology, so that you basically, an apartment in Manhattan could power itself with a few solar batteries and solar cells, then you could see that kind of transformation take place. The way I sometimes put it, in New York City, the biggest pollution problem we had in 1910 was horse manure. We were knee-deep in it. By 1920, the internal combustion engine drove that out of the marketplace. We didn't tax, the horse-drawn carriage. What we did is we created a technology that was far better. We have to do the same thing for energy now.
All right. Thank you very much. And, you know, a lot of it is happening, as you say, in the grassroots level. Steve Cohen is Executive Director of Columbia University's Earth Institute in New York. Lisa Friedman, Deputy Editor of Climate Wire in Paris. Thanks for staying up with us, Lisa. And good luck to you in Paris. And give our regards.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Top. Décollage.
There you go. Rocket launch. Hang on. Room shaking. They are captivating, aren't they? And sometimes, you know, if you've followed them over the years, they are unpredictable. Some explode on the launch pad. Others get lost in space. And this one we were just listening to, that was the launch of the European Space Agency's two Galileo 5 and 6 satellites. The satellites made it into space, but a technical glitch push them into the wrong orbit. Details. Details. Ah, of course you can't let, though, a good satellite go to waste. So two groups of physicists have repurposed these satellites to make the best of a bad situation, repurposed them to test general relativity, a fitting idea for this year, the 100th birthday of Einstein's famous idea. My next guest is on one of those teams. Sven Hermann is an experimental physicist at the Center of Applied Space Technology and Microgravity. That's out of the University of Bremen in Germany. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me.
So you're now going to use these satellites. How do you use them to test general relativity?
Well, as you maybe, I don't know if you mentioned that, but these satellites are now on a very eccentric orbit. So they were supposed to go on a circular orbit. Now they're on an eccentric orbit, and that means with these clocks on board of the satellites, they are changing their altitude in the gravitational potential. And that gives us an excellent opportunity to test the gravitational redshift or the gravitational time dilation. So that's a very basic prediction of general relativity, that a clock that is closer to a massive object like Earth will seem to tick a bit more slowly than a clock that is located further away. And the clocks on board of those satellites, they are now just exactly doing this. They are approaching Earth and going back and forth with every revolution on the orbit that they do, about twice a day.
How much in seconds, in fractions of a second, would you see to justify or to back up the Einstein's theory?
So that's on the order, I think, we put it in the shift in the frequency. The shift in the frequency is 10 to the minus 11, or 1 part in 10 to the 11. And that's caused by a change in altitude on the order of 8,000 kilometers per orbit. So if you put that into seconds, I think you end up with something on the order of microseconds.
Wow.
Several 10 or 100 microseconds, yes.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about this interesting experiment with these satellites. So you have to see, so you had to find satellites, though, that had clocks on them, right? Not all the satellites have the kind of clocks that you would need, but these two did.
So the clocks in the Galileo program, I mean, they are all, there are rubidium atomic clocks and there are passive hydrogen masers, and they are all kind of the same model that is used in the global satellite navigation system, Galileo, like in GPS. So these are pretty good clocks. They are maybe not the world's best clocks, but they are designed for the purpose of positioning and navigation. And I think they are sufficient for the test that we want to do.
Why do we continue to need to test Einstein's theories of relativity?
That's a good question. I think this general relativity is just such a very basic theory. It's essentially defining our understanding of space and time. So it's the very basic of physics that I think it's our, we're obliged more or less to really test this fundamental theory to the best what technology can provide us with. And we should use, I think, every chance to look at the fundamentals and the principles that this theory is built on. And especially if you look at the problem that is something many physicists try to tackle today, is the unification of gravity theory, that's general relativity, and quantum theory on the other hand. Those two big theories in physics, they are seemingly incompatible. And if you want to formulate a theory of quantum gravity, a unified theory of those two, you might have to change some of the basics that these theories are built on. And so maybe at some level of precision, you might find small deviations in the fundamentals of general relativity. And so, unfortunately, we don't know at what precision we will find the deviation. So it might be around the corner, it might be orders of magnitude away. But as I said, my philosophy is just do the best test you can with the technology you have at hand. And with this satellites, I think we have a good opportunity to improve these tests.
Well, we'll await your results. It sounds quite exciting, and we wish you the best of luck.
Well, the results, we have have scheduled now to do collect the data that these satellites provide us with more or less for free over the course of 1 year. So
okay.
We want to have 1 year of data that may help us to disentangle the signal that we are looking for from some systematic errors or systematic effects.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got
appear,
we'll check back in a year. We've got to say goodbye, Sven. Sven Hermann, experimental physicist at the Center of Applied Space Technology and Microgravity at the University of Bremen. One last thing before we go. Late last week came word that Amir Axel had passed away, and he wrote a slew of books, many dealing with math on topics as diverse as Fermat's Last Theorem, Monks and Evolution, Ancient Cave Art, Uranium, Religion, The Hunt for the Higgs Boson. He joined me many times on this program over the years, and I was always struck by his humor and his ability to describe complexity in simple terms, as in this description of Hilbert's paradox and infinity.
There's a better way of seeing, and that's my all-time favorite about infinity, and that's called the Infinite Hotel, or Hilbert's Hotel. So you go to this hotel someplace, and you need a room. You're very tired, and it's called the Infinite Hotel. So you think, certainly we'll find a room here. But the person at the desk says, I'm sorry, we have infinitely many rooms, but they're all full. There's no vacancy. And so you say, okay, I'm a mathematician. Right. I should be able to solve this problem. And you tell the person at the desk, take the person in room one, move him or her to room two, the person in room two to room three to room four, and you have room one for me right now. So that's the idea of infinity, that you can really do very strange things. You can always extract a finite quantity from an infinite one.
Amir Axel passed away too soon last week at the age of 65. That's about it for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, Luke Ruskin, our video producer, production assistant Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer, spinning the dials here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you're hunting for the perfect weekend to get away, how about Iceland? The country is a geological marvel with volcanoes, glaciers, cold deserts, you name it. It's the subject of our PsyCandy web series this week. Go to sciencefriday.com/Iceland and enjoy the trip. I'll repeat that again. It sounds like a good place. sciencefriday.com/Iceland. Enjoy the trip. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.